This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bootsy Collins, is one of the most celebrated funk bass players. Now he has a new best-of record called Back in the Day, and he has his first album of new music in 6 years featuring a new rubber band. From that new album, Blasters of the Universe, this is Funk Express Card. Bootsy Collins learned to play funk as a teenager when he was a sideman in James Brown's band during the Sex Machine era. From there, he teamed up with George Clinton, combining funk with science fiction and psychedelia. Then Collins formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. He created the stage persona Bootzilla, an outsized name to go with his flashy costumes and monster-sized eyeglasses. Hip-hop groups have paid homage to him by using his records as their rhythm tracks. Well, let's get started with the 1970 recording featuring Bootsy Collins on bass with James Brown's Superbad.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it! Watch me! I got it! Hey! I got something that makes me want to shout. I got something that tells me what it's all about. I got soul, and I'm super bad. I got soul, and I'm super bad.
Do you remember that first night you performed with James Brown on stage?
Oh, man. You know what? I remember it, but I don't actually remember what happened. I remember playing there, and I remember the people when I walked in, you know, because we were late. I mean, well, the band was late, and the show, the whole show was late. It was pretty incredible because the people were chanting, "We want James, we want James," and we was walking through the audience. They was looking at us and saying, "There's the band, let's get them, let's get them." So it was kind of strange for us, you know, but it all kind of worked out after we got to the stage.
No, did he have to fly you down because his band walked out?
Yeah, they were, as a matter of fact, they hadn't walked out yet. They were still there when we walked in, and they were our buddies, you know, they were our heroes. And it's like, you know how you do when you cross the strike line, man? It's like, whoa, you know, so we felt really strange because we felt really closer to the band than anything else, you know. And here we are walking in and getting ready to do their gig. We didn't realize that until we got there. We thought we were just coming down to do it. James wanted us to do a gig, you know, with him. We didn't know we was coming in and replacing the old band, you know. It was like, wow, it was a whole new ball game when we got there.
So did you feel you had to ask permission or apologize?
Pretty much, you know, that was pretty much the feeling, you know, because we really respected these guys, you know. They were Fred Wesley, Maceo, you know, Melvin, the drummer, Clyde. I mean, you know, these were like our idols. And, man, you know, to walk in and do their gig, you know, it was like, wow, who are we, you know?
Well, listen, I went back to James Brown's autobiography to see what he had to say about you.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So he writes, "I think Bootsy learned a lot from me. When I met him, he was playing a lot of bass, the ifs, ands, and the buts.
Yeah, he's right.
I got him to see the importance of the one in funk, the downbeat at the beginning of every bar.
That's right.
I got him to key in on the dynamic parts of the one instead of playing all around it.
Yeah.
Then he could do all of his stuff in the right places after the one."
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, absolutely correct.
No, was it hard to make the adjustment to playing on the one?
No, because I knew he knew something. I mean, you know, you know, and I was there to learn. It wasn't like, you know, this is my part and I'll fly if I want to. I knew it was James's party, you know, and whatever he knew, I wanted to find out because, you know, he just had this, the band was the tightest band in the land and he had this thing going on. We wanted to find out what the heck it was, you know.
Now, had you been playing on the 2 and 4 before?
I started playing on the with a guitar, and I wasn't actually a bass player yet. Mm-hmm. So I was learning to play bass, you know, and I wanted to play bass. So it was like, all those other if, ands, and buts is what I was playing when I picked up the bass, you know? It was like, oh, you mean I got to play on the dominant note? Oh, okay. So it was like all brand new to me, you know? And I just didn't feel like a normal bass player, you know? So, but by James telling me that, it all kind of made sense. And once I started hearing it, you know, what was actually happening when I did that, it was like, oh, and then I can still do this and I can still do that. So it was a groove. It was really a groove.
And let me play one of the recordings you made with James Brown. Why don't we hear Sex Machine? And do you want to say anything about the rhythm you're playing on this?
That's pretty much the whole rhythm is what I figure I've been doing ever since. When you hear Sex Machine, that's pretty much where I'm at now.
Okay, here we go.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute. Shake your arm. And use your palm. Stay on the scene. I like a sex machine. You got to have the feeling. Sure as your bone. Get it together. Right on, right on. Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
My guest is Bootsy Collins. Now, tell me how your image changed when you started playing with James Brown. What you did on stage, what you wore on stage.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. What I wore on stage. Oh, man. As you know, I may not know, those were the days like in the 60s, getting ready to go into the 70s. But, you know, it was another kind of movement going on. And kids were like coming up front and wearing like bleached jeans and T-shirts and afros and, you know, the granny glasses, and, you know, we was all freaking out. We was having a freaking party, you know, and I don't know, then here we are, we're playing with James Brown, and, you know, we're in the Army now, you know. It's like, whoa. You know, so it's like, but it was good for the fact that it kind of brought us off of the street. We were out there doing what everybody else was doing, acting crazy, throwing firebombs and doing everything, you know. So getting with James kind of brought us off of the street. And, you know, I think we kind of realized that. And at the same time, you know, it gave us the opportunity of really doing something that we wanted to do. So, you know, we kind of put everything else in the back seat because this is what we wanted to do. Even though, you know, we wanted to dress crazy. We didn't know how crazy we wanted to dress, but we didn't want to wear suits. You know, we knew that.
You know? So you were wearing matching suits on stage while everybody else was wearing jeans and tie-dye T-shirts?
Yeah, while this movement was going on, the peace, the love, that was going on. And, you know, here we are, you know, getting stuck with wearing suits and patent leather shoes, you know. And but at that time, you know, it was a start of it, so it was cool, you know. We said, well, we'll eat this because, you know, we definitely, you know, want to be with James, you know. So if you want to be with James, that's what you had to do.
So you left the band after just a couple of years.
Yeah.
What was the turning point for you that made you think, it's time now, I'm getting out?
Well, you know, I got you know, all the other bands was coming up wearing the freaky stuff that I said, well, wow, I could have did that 3 years ago. You know? And, you know, I mean, it was, you know, it was like that. And then it was like, you know, you just want to do things the way you want to do them on stage. You want to go crazy. You want to freak out, you know, because that's what time it was, you know. And here we were just standing up there being the tightest band in the land. But, you know, it was only a certain amount of movement you can do, you know. You couldn't jump out in the audience and freak out and act crazy, you know. Like, that's what it was going to, you know. And that's what we wanted to do, you know. We just wanted to have a low down, hold down, and, you know, drip until you wet type party.
Shortly after you left James Brown, you met George Clinton.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you think of him as taking James Brown's music to the next step?
Not really. When I got with George, I wasn't even thinking like that. I was just looking at George more of, this is a way that I can really expound on what I really want to do. Because George had like an open door, looseness that I could relate to, because he knew what I was reaching for. And he kind of opened arms and said, okay, if you help me with Parliament Funkadelic writing songs and doing this and playing in a band, then you know, one day, you know, at the same time, you can do your band and you can do a solo thing, you know, and we'll be working on that all at the same time.
So, I mean, George Clinton is pretty outrageous on stage. So what did that bring out in you, and what were your first steps on stage toward becoming the different personalities on stage that you became?
Well, George was pretty much what any young kid would need, and that's encouragement that whether the world is saying you're doing something right or cool or not. George said, whatever I was doing, cool. That's all I needed, you know? Because once he said, I already felt it was cool anyway. I didn't really need nobody to tell me that. But for him to say that and for him to be who he was, and he was the craziest man in the universe, and that's what I wanted to be, you know? So for him to say that, it was like, whoa, man, this is bigger than life, you know? And not only say that, but he gave me the opportunity to do it. And that, to me, was the step that I needed, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about the stage images, the stage personas you created for yourself?
Well, I've always dreamed of that kind of stuff in school, you know, the twinkle, twinkle, the stars, and reaching for the stars, and one day maybe playing a guitar that's made out of a star and maybe seeing through stars. So, you know, I kind of dreamed of that kind of stuff in school. And when I got with George, I figured that this was the opportune time to make that a reality. And that's when I became in search of people to make the glasses and make the bases. And, you know, we have a star fulfill type thing going on.
Now, just describe the glasses as you first started wearing them, and how'd you get them made for you?
Well, the same people that made Elton John's glasses, Optique Boutique out in California. I think they kind of felt sorry for me. I kind of whimpered in off the street, you know. And, you know, I had this lowly, humble thing going on. And they said, come on in, kid. What you need, you know? I said, well, I need some star glasses. And they kind of laughed at me at first. And I kind of drew them out a little bit. And they said, okay. They said, how much money you got to spend, kid? I said, well, actually none. They laughed at me again, you know. But I think they really did feel sorry for me. And they kind of got me a pair up for about $100. They were prescriptions, too. So they kind of went with me, but the next time I went to get some star glasses, they kind of made me they charged me maybe triple, you know, but it was cool.
When you started wearing those really, really big glasses, were those prescription too?
Yeah. All of them were prescriptions. Yeah, definitely.
Well, that must be strange.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty good for me because I could really see the audience. See, before then, I couldn't really actually see the audience, what was happening out there. You know, all I could do was hear them, and I knew they were out there, but I couldn't see what the funk was going on. But now I can.
My guest is Bootsy Collins. He has a new best of CD called Back in the Day, plus a CD of new music called Blasters of the Universe. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bootsy Collins. After playing bass with James Brown, he teamed up with George Clinton, then formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. So what were the pressures on you of actually having to manage a band and take care of business, take care of salaries, take care of discipline, make sure people showed up for gigs, and that they were, even if they were high, they were able to perform?
Yeah, it was pretty strange, you know, because I never really, you know, looked at really taking care of it on that level. You know, it was always a ghetto level with me. You know, we always rode around in cars, maybe eight, nine people in the car and equipment, you know. So I never really looked at a serious, you know, having to take care of people. And, you know, I never really felt that, you know, until I actually got with George and we started doing Bootsy's Rubber Band, you know. I never felt that before. So when it hit me, it was like, whoa, you know, because all I was thinking was I was out here to, you know, enjoy people and people to enjoy me, and we're going to have a big old party, you know. And beer to go, you know. So it just didn't happen like that, you know. I started having to take care of this truck and rent, you know, sound gear and making sure everybody was there and, you know, everybody's babies is hungry. And I had to kind of be responsible for everybody, you know. And it was a whole nother ball game. So, I don't know, I just had to grow up, you know, a little bit here and there.
Did you hate that aspect of the work?
Yeah, pretty. After a while, I pretty much did, because it took me away from what I actually came out there to do.
Music.
Yeah. I mean, I hated it, you know. I hated it. But at the same time, you know, I was in it, you know. That's why I kind of feel like I was at the point where Jimmy was at and where Sly Stone was at. And a lot of the people that go through, you know, the stuff that they get to that point, you know, and it's like you don't know what the heck to do because there's no books on it, you know.
What point are you talking about?
That point of what the heck do you do? You know you got to to do this, you know, and you got to take care of this and you got to take care of that. But at the same time, you just want to play music, you know. And when you get to that point, you don't know what the heck to do. It's like, wow, what do you do?
So what did you do?
I stopped, you know.
Stopped what?
I just stopped playing music. I just stopped and just everybody thought I was crazy, you know. And I thought I was crazy too, you know, because at that point we was doing stadium dates. I was making like $100,000, you know, per stadium. And could nobody understand why I stopped, you know.
How long did you stop for?
It was probably, let's see, I mean, I would say a good six years before I even thought about messing back with it, you know.
When you got back into performing again, what did you do differently?
It was all a trying. I didn't know what to do differently. I just knew what I didn't want to do. And what I didn't want to do is have all that responsibility and, you know, and don't know what to do with it. That was the hard part.
So what's your plan now for
being out here now?
Yeah.
I'm just going to do what I got to do. And when I come off the stage, you know, that cat stays on the stage, you know. It's just I go back to the farm with the rest of the aliens. You know, and I mean, you know, it's just a way of life. You know, you have to separate it. I never knew that. You know, I always wanted to be Bootsy and Bootzilla, you know. I mean, that was 27 miles a day. It's like Bugs Bunny, man. Don't he get a chance to not be Bugs Bunny? No. You know, so it was a whole new ball game, you know, and I kind of had to come up with ideas of how to do this, how to be on like a light and then turn myself off when I got to be off, you know.
Let me play one of the classic Bootsy records. Why don't I play Bootzilla?
Oh.
And this is one of the tracks reissued on a new Warner collection called Back in the Day, The Best of Bootsy.
Yeah.
Did I say something about writing and recording this?
Let's see. That was in, I think it was in 78, right? 1978. And we'd done that at the P-Funk Lab in Detroit. And it was George Clinton, myself. We just kind of went in and winged it. And all of a sudden, the monster was born. The rock star doll baby bubble. Yeah.
This is Bootsy Collins from his new Warner Brothers collection.
Yeah! Just wind me up. Put me on your credit card, man. And at no extra expense comes this remote control unit. Oh yeah, I'm programmable. One heck of a doll, baby mama. Bootzilla here. Made by the makers of funky things to play with. Trademark Funk Attack Incorporated, mama.
Pull my string.
That's Bootzilla. You know, I'm wondering what you think about rap performers who've sampled your music on their records. Do you think of it as robbery or as homage?
I think it's more like, I guess you would say they kind of kept the funk alive, you know, because the new kids didn't have a clue about us at first, you know. And then the rappers came on with the, you know, sampling the funk and, you know, getting it out and, I think my hat's is off to them, you know, because they kind of kept it alive. It gave me an opportunity to come back around a second time. And, you know, a lot of people don't get that chance.
Do you think some of the rappers initially heard your records through their parents?
Yeah, definitely. As a matter of fact, a lot of them told me that, you know, and a lot of them would tell me that they wanted to come to the show. Like Ice Cube, he was telling me we did this this live stadium date out in L.A., and he wanted to come to the show. He said he was around 10 years old, and his mama wouldn't let him, you know. And he was wired. I mean, he was really upset about he couldn't make it, you know. But he was telling me about that, and it was like, wow, man. The parents kind of passed the records down. That's kind of where they picked up on it at.
Now, I want to ask you a couple things about your bass. You actually started off playing guitar.
Yeah.
And then you started using bass strings on the guitar.
Yeah.
And that's how you started playing bass. Well, why didn't you get a bass?
Money. I didn't have any money. You know, it was like my mother had bought me this guitar because I had begged her, you know, for years, right, about this one guitar, man. And she finally got it for me. And then I decided that I want to play bass, you know. And you know, it's like, come on, man. It took me all these years to get this guitar, you know. So what it was my brother was, you know, he was like playing guitar. And I realized that I wanted to be in a band with him. after I got a guitar. So how was I going to be in a band with him playing guitar? And he's the guitar player. So I decided, wow, I got to become the bass player. So that's when that big thing came up with, okay, well, I'll take some bass strings and I'll put them on my guitar and I'll play bass with him. You know, this was my big dream to just play with him.
Now, I think James Brown gave you your first bass.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah.
What was it like learning to actually play bass on bass instead of on guitar?
Well, you know, the only difference, I think, was the neck was longer. You know, because the strings were pretty much the same. I had put bass strings on the guitar, so they were pretty much the same. It felt the same, but I think the neck was longer because James had got me this Fender Jazz bass, you know, and it was a long sucker, and it was like, whoa, wow. It was like a Cadillac, you know? Yeah.
Now, one of your new records is dedicated in part to all your friends in the kitchens and jails across the world doing hard time.
Yeah.
The kitchens?
Yeah. When I was, playing these big coliseums and big time, everything was going on groovy, groovy, great. You know, I don't know, everybody just kind of related to me out of the kitchens of the Holiday Inns and the Ramadas, and I always went back, signed autographs, and I never forgot that because I used to work in the kitchen myself, you know, when I was coming up, like 11, when I was 11 years old, I was like, I'd go get a job, I suppose I'd been like 16 or 18, I told them I was, you know, 16, I told a little white lie every now and then, and by me being tall, you know, they thought I was like 16 or 18, yeah, you know, you can have a job, and then they'd take me in there, work me to death, put me under the stoves, I'd be cleaning under the stove, but it was groove, you know, because I finally got me a radio. And that's pretty much what started it all.
And you're dedicated also to people in jails.
Yeah.
A lot of your fans or people you know.
People I know, you know. And not only that, like I said, I kind of came up the same way and everybody around me was going to jail. And the only thing that kept me out of jail was the music. That's what kept me out.
Thank you so much for doing the interview.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine.
Bootsy Collins, he has his first new album in 6 years. It's called Blasters of the Universe, and he has a new best of album called Back in the Day. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.